history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be heard, and we're never going to have that privilege unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen to the answers that come our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation, and we're in for quite a story today in Laguna Woods, California, with 95-year-old Don Stoutenborough. And Don, we're going to hear about P-38s, we're going to hear about a Purple Heart, a Distinguished Flying Cross, and a very important piece of 16-millimeter film. But I want to hear about your growing up years, not too far from here in Riverside, California, which I'm guessing was a little different in the 20s and 30s than it is today.
Oh, my goodness. I came when I was 4 years old to Riverside, and I can recall very early aroma, you know, because the orange blossoms, it's all over the place. Of course, not today, but you had orange growers in town, actually. A whole city block was given over to one house, and he had his orange grove around it. So I got to watch that town change.
Were you picking them off the tree on your way home from school, or what?
No, but I went to many schools. That family joke is when the rent came due, I went to another school. Not quite, but we were poor. My father sold Hoover vacuum cleaners. Oh, it beats as it sweeps as it cleans. That's it. That's all right. It's very good, actually.
So he would go door to door selling vacuums?
Oh, of course, he had to do that. Yeah. They would, who wants to spend money during the Depression, you know?
And you were an only child.
Unfortunately, yes. My mother wasn't very well, and she died when she was only 36.
And you were 12 when 12. She passed away. Mm-hmm. What do you remember about those childhood years as far as your ambitions or what you thought you might be doing when you grew up someday?
I wanted to fly, period. Now, I know lots of kids wanted to do that, but I really did. It was almost an obsession. I bothered my folks about it. We had relatives in Arcadia, and we would drive over to Arcadia on a Sunday, and on the route was a little airport with a big sign out of that. Ride in a plane, $5. Well, I saw that. I can remember when I first saw it, I thought, oh, wow, that's what I get to do. So I was pretty intense about this. Of course, my parents were, I'm an only kid, and I suppose I'm spoiled. But they were very good to me, and it was of a great relation. I loved my father and my mother. Anyway, my father had a thing. We'd go out and take a ride. You'd go for rides. That was entertainment. And he would pull this one. We would come to a little stand out on the road, you know, send date shakes, for instance, down mm-hmm. Palm Springs. And so he would take the keys out of the ignition and say, oh, this car. Because we'd parked in front of this shake place, you see, and here we are. And he says, oh, Mama, take him out for a walk, and I'll fix the car. We go out and say, oh, here's the shake place, and that's what we have, you know.
So he would fake car trouble to get you a date shake.
Yeah, or whatever. He was just spoiling me, I guess. But mm-hmm. And I didn't catch on to this for a long time. I thought, that car is always having trouble.
So did he spring for that $5 flight on the road to Arcadia?
Well, I guess he must have given up, because I would mention it, you know. I'd point out that that's a beautiful little airport and there's a sign, and they give. But $5? Come on now. This is 1928 to 32. I'm 6 and 10. It's in that period. Here was this sign on the road. And I continue to point it out, and I knew they were getting tired of that. And then all of a sudden, one day, his car just didn't work right in front of the place. And I thought, oh, I get to fly. And so, I mean, I flew. I sat on my mother's lap.
What kind of plane was that?
It was probably the first version of a Stearman. And this is an open cockpit biplane, seat in front and back. And when I went with my mother, we sat in the back. And I sat on her lap. I caught the bug. I really did. It was serious with me. I thought about doing that. My friends all made artificial planes and hung them up in their bedrooms, you know. That never appealed to me. But getting in writing a poem, 10 years later, I had another experience in a biplane, a Stearman, when I was in primary. That's when the civilians ran that primary program. So up in Oxnard, this guy had his own runway. The war started, and he was in it because he built a whole bunch of huts, and he made a pot of money.
Well, let's talk about the build-up to that. So your father had been in World War One.
Yes.
Did you ever hear stories about what he experienced, what he went through?
Yeah, he didn't go overseas, so he didn't get gassed like a couple of his friends. That was pretty spooky, getting gassed, you know.
But as you're going through high school, is there any sense that America could be drawn into a war, that something like this could happen?
We were so unprepared. It's just incredible. When you read the stories, I mean, we had all the planes lined up on every airport in the Pacific area, and we were all over the Pacific, weren't we? No plane was sheltered or put in a revetment, you know. On and on and on and on and on. I mean, you think about here, we broke the Japanese code when the war for us, of course. And we were smart enough to do that, but we weren't smart enough to know that we were irritating those Japanese by being arrogant, and the oil was a difficult thing for them, you know. Obviously, they didn't have a clue.
And so you personally didn't see this coming?
No, I had no, absolutely none.
So you get the news that Japan has attacked Pearl Harbor, America is now at war. And how long did you wait to try to get flying?
As quickly, I'm not joking about this. I knew, when I heard about the war, I thought, I'm out. I went into the city. I didn't have a car, but in those days, you could hitch a ride.
Sure.
It wasn't dangerous. So you just get out on the highway, and I'd go into Los Angeles, and I went in there and signed up immediately that I could. When I sat on my mother's lap, 10 years later, I flew in that same like plane, but it was a real Stearman. I was in the service. I was a cadet.
And before long, that cadet would be flying the P-38 Lightning in combat. But you actually saw that legendary aircraft fly before anybody else really even knew it existed. If anybody ever has the chance to visit the Marchfield Air Museum in Riverside, California, you can learn about that base's connection to test pilot Ben Kelsey and the development of the P-38. In February of 1939, Kelsey made a record-breaking transcontinental flight that started at Marchfield and ended on the East Coast. It was in the prototype version of the Lightning called the XP-38. And Don, you actually saw him flying that plane there in Riverside before World War II?
Oh boy. I come to Riverside from John Marshall. I was a performer. I was a monologist. I didn't want to be a stand-up comic. Never heard that word. But I was a popular guy on the campus.
You like to entertain.
Oh, whoa, if there was a show, I wanted to be in it, really. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any fear about anything like that. This is Los Angeles, big school, John Marshall. Just 4 months before we're going to walk and have our graduation, for the second time in this career, my father moves me to another school. So he moves me to Riverside. Well, we'd lived in Riverside way before, but not to come there at the last moment. I'm graduating in John Marshall. I didn't create the story, by the way. In fact, I don't think I could. They wouldn't believe it. But you're going to have to believe it. I'd go out and I'd run. I'd take my bike out to the hills and I'd run. Out in the hills where you could see March Air Force Base. Now, there wasn't a heck of a lot of activity out there, but there was something activity. And then one day I saw coming this plane. I'd never seen this plane. Remember, I'm out there running and I'm stopping because it's only probably 8 miles and you can see Marchfield from these hills. And I couldn't figure out what that plane was, and it made its little turn. It had no inside. I'd never seen a P-38 before. Who was driving that plane? His name was Kelsey. He was a first lieutenant. He was enamored of this idea of building this plane, and he was a friend of Hap Arnold's. Now, this doesn't make any sense. This movie script doesn't work. How does a first lieutenant know Hap Arnold? Well, he did. He was brilliant, brilliant kid. And Hap Arnold knew he was, and he got helped to go forward with a project, which was the P-38 project. And he flew the prototype of that P-38, the only person that ever flew it. And I was looking out there, and here comes this plane that I'd never seen before. And I came to, you know, came back to school and said, hey, you know, I saw this plane. This kid from Los Angeles is always making up stories.
So nobody believed you, but you
they
actually...
They really didn't.
You saw the P-38 before most people knew what it was.
Precisely, and I still didn't know what it was. And it was only when... Very quickly, I knew what it was, even though they were trying to keep it secret, because this Kelsey fellow was going to beat the Howard Hughes' race to New York from Los Angeles. When I saw that plane and so forth, I put it all together finally. It had to be that pilot because no one else flew the plane.
And before long, they're mass-producing them at a plant in Burbank, which they would then have to camouflage so the Japanese wouldn't bomb it. But
exactly.
Then you end up flying it for 76 missions
That's right.
In the war. What was that plane like to fly? Very few people alive have flown a P-38. So what was it like?
It was an absolute joy. You take off and there was no, you didn't have to push on a rudder like that to keep it down the runway. It was counter-rotating. Landing was a joy because if you just aimed it correctly, the nice tricycle gear, which is, oh, so beautiful. You landed on the others and then your third wheel would touch down, you know. Of course, now listen, I would say any plane I ever flew was just wonderful, wonderful, because I flew 51s in the National Guard. But nothing was like a P-38. You knew how much glass was behind you if you're going to be hit with guns. You know, you got 4 inches of, I hope it would stop a bullet. First, we learned to fly the P-38 in Muroc.
Yep.
Before they call it Edwards. Wonderful place, wonderful plane. Of course, you had to survive the blindfold test with a cockpit. I mean, you did it. The first lieutenant stood there, and you were blindfolded, and he was calling out what? And you had to find it.
You had to point to every instrument without being able to see it.
You had to point to, you had to touch it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to have lights someday, buddy, you know? You're going to be in the dark, and you're going to have some emergency, and your electrical's out, and you don't have any lights. What are you going to do? How are you going to save yourself? So that was real, and we all did it seriously. Sounds like a joke, you know. Do your, oh, no, 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 no. Be sure that you can do it. They told you. You have to pass this, you know.
Tell me about flying it in combat. What was your first mission?
We had come over there to help the Salerno invasion. And so they put us in Sicily with an air base right beneath Mount Etna. So we'd take off and we'd go up and down the coast to warn the Germans that we were still there because they were very heavy. They didn't want to give up that country, you know. First of all, we were very well trained. When I came overseas, I wasn't on the manifest the first time, but I came in later, and so they had all had some missions. And so I was listening to them talk about those missions before I was flying them. And they were my buddies from before, and so they'd tell me things, you know. It was an education. I was learning more from just my friends who had already flown missions than I was learning any other way. Believe me, they were very careful in my squadron of being sure you had experience, that you went out there, we did practice runs like that. We had to exchange notes and what happened and so forth and so on, because we've been losing guys.
Well, and that's what I want to understand. And how old were you when you flew your first mission over there?
Of 20.
20 years old, flying a P-38 against the Germans. And you talk about needing to survive. In 76 missions, I'm sure you faced a lot of things that threatened your survival, from anti-aircraft to enemy planes to weather, malfunctioning engines perhaps. What are some of the things that stand out that you look back on and say, boy, I was pretty fortunate to come home from that one?
Almost everything that happened to me. Well, first of all, this was not serious as it was on the continent. The emissions that they were flying were far, far, far more dangerous than ours. When we first got there, we were doing strafing work. We were doing accompanying some B-25s somewhere to do a little bombing.
You'd escort them on
their
bomb runs?
Escort them, that's right. Uh-huh. When we moved to Italy, to the airfields around Foggia, we began to be the cover for the B-24s because we had 20 airfields. We attacked 10 important ones with that strafing mission, which was so amazing and so successful.
Successful enough to earn a distinguished unit citation for the 95th Fighter Squadron, part of the 82nd Fighter Group. Don Stoutenborough would receive individual decorations as well, including the Distinguished Flying Cross and the Purple Heart before he finished his 76 missions. There are some pretty interesting stories surrounding those medals and also some unique cargo that he carried late in the war. If you head over to hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find some photos of Mr. Stoutenborough then and now, including some taken by Zach Coco of the Pictures for Heroes Project. You've heard me discuss it before on this program, and we're going to hear from the man behind it in a future episode. But take a look today at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I've found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
3328. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 95-year-old Don Stoutenborough of Laguna Woods, California. He flew 76 missions in P-38 Lightnings with the 95th Squadron of the 82nd Fighter Group in two separate tours of duty in Italy. He came home after 50 missions but was hungry for more. His squadron was credited with destroying 400 enemy aircraft, including 199 air-to-air victories. Two of those 199 belonged to Don, one on October 8th of 1943, another 3 months later on January 14th, 1944. Eventually, we're going to hear some of his mixed emotions about those, but how about the emotions that flow when you find out a fellow pilot did not bring his P-38 back from a mission?
It hurt. It really hurt when you lost a guy because you knew him. It hurt to be in somebody's bed that he just died and they put you in his bed, which they did.
Yeah.
One time, when I first came over, and when I finally get there, I'm put in a dead man's bed, and, oh, he played bridge much better than you are, Stout. You know, you're not as funny as Braglin is, you know. I'm sorry, but he was funny. So my tent mates were giving me a bad time sleeping in the bed of a guy who had been shot down. I didn't find that very funny. I thought that was crude.
Well, and doesn't it occur to you at some point that might happen to you?
I guess it really, what am I going to say? I didn't have any fear of that somehow. Of course, it had to occur to me. We had a mission once that scared the hell out of me. We were going to attack some boats way up in the top of Italy, and it was a dangerous mission. We flew our thing in, and they had guns on both sides firing at us as we were coming in to do the killing of these boats. And I saw bullets coming. That really scared me because you could see the bullets coming by you, the tracers. We knew where those bullets were coming from. And so that was kind of, let's get out of this situation.
So as you're diving for these boats, you're seeing fire come from both directions across in front of your nose.
Perfectly. We were just suckers, do you see?
And I'm sure there had to be some times where you brought that P-38 in with a few holes in it.
Oh, yeah. But the thing was it was like a bull. You know, we couldn't stop that. It was. You see pictures of them coming home with the damage. Actually, an engine, there's one picture in one of these books here, torn out from the plane, gone. The engine's gone. You got a hole where there's one gone. The engine's gone. You got a hole where there's one engine was. And he lands it. He brings it home on one engine. It was a very rugged plane.
And what about those 76 missions for you? Were there somewhere you didn't think you were going to make it back?
I don't know that I ever had that I'm not going to make it. I suppose it was there, but I tell you, I was having so much fun. It's not hubris I'm talking about here now. It's just the fact that I always wanted to fly. Mm-hmm. This plane was the magnificent plane to fly. And you talk to people, and they say, you fly a P-38? You know, I said, yep, get one. You're never going to be sorry for this one. They go fast, they go clean, and they take bullets. You can come home with one engine shot out and so forth.
I'm looking over there, and there's a medal there called the Purple Heart, and they usually don't hand those out unless something happens to you. So where'd that come from?
I told the doctor, I said, I don't, the doctor gives it to me in the hospital because I've been burned. I said, I'm not in combat at this. I was leading the group. Are you ready? This was on my second tour. And so I'm a big shot. So I get to lead the group. Fine. That didn't mean anything. It just means you were the first plane. You knew, you talked to the bombers, you know. My plane, we don't know. My first engine goes out, right engine goes out. We're up over enemy territory, but not very far. We haven't even got our altitude, and we're about at Venice, and that engine goes out, period. It's dead. I feather it, and I give Walker. He was the leader of the 92nd. I'm the 95th. And so I call him, say, I have to go home, so take over. Well, it didn't mean anything. It didn't change anything. He was still going to meet the bombers at the same place, and he knew what to do. I start home. We were at some altitude, but not very much. I'm spoken of as just having taken off in the books. Like, my accident was because I didn't get to the target. It says, you know, just at takeoff or something.
But you're telling me you were actually over enemy territory.
Yes, I'm there.
Right.
But it's not much. Remember, they still have part of Italy. Mm-hmm. We flew up the Adriatic. We didn't fly over the ground. You go up the Adriatic. Nobody shoots you from there. If you come home, come down Adriatic, you see. Don't go across. But I got one engine, and I don't want to go into the water. So I'm over their land and then our land.
So the rest of the P-38s are going on to meet the bombers to rendezvous, but you have to turn around and come back by yourself, no other planes.
That's right.
On one engine.
On one engine.
And you don't want to go over the water because you don't want to take that chance.
Exactly.
So you're coming in over the land, and some of that's German-held, and you're hoping to make it back to your base.
Exactly.
All right.
That's exactly the situation.
So what happened?
Well, my other engine. Now, come on. You lose two engines. No, you don't. But why in the hell did this one start coughing? Well, I'm thinking about jumping very quickly now, just when it starts coughing. Because if you got one engine gone and this one is... I can't figure out why, what's going on. Nobody's shooting at me that I know about. You know, I'm over land and I think I'm past the line. I'm in safe territory. I'm in our territory. I thought, I didn't know precisely, but the line was not very far from where I landed. Anyway, that engine went out on me and it sunk like a rock. I could not believe without an engine what that plane did. It was just It weighs 7 tons, you know.
So you're coming down in a hurry.
I'm coming down in a hurry, and I don't have time. I don't have time to go jump out. I was still thinking about the bar in the back. But I knew people had jumped out, and I knew what to do. Turn the plane over and just fall out.
Because if you don't do that, the plane itself is going to kill you.
Exactly.
If you don't invert the P-38 and drop out, the plane's movement is going to force you into the fork between the tails and your gonzo.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So you knew how to bail out, but you didn't think you had time.
No, I did not have time because I was ready for there was an airfield up there. I knew I was in our territory because I knew that airfield. I couldn't make it. I knew where it was, but I couldn't make it. I was losing altitude, and I didn't want to jump. I really didn't. Something would make that engine go, you know. It didn't. It wouldn't.
But you're hoping that as you pick up speed and dropping altitude, that maybe that engine would kick back in.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
But that didn't happen.
That did not happen. The thing you sat in was you couldn't brake it anything there. That was too strong. The plane could be collapsing on you, and you're in your little gondola, and you're safe. And you crash-landed, and you'll survive in that plane, no problem.
And that's what happened? And
that's precisely what happened. Right next door to a hospital, I saw that cross coming down, and I thought, my God, don't hit the hospital, Stoutenboro. I landed in an olive grove beside the hospital. I got out of the plane. I was carrying my parachute, and you look very funny, trying to run away from a plane that who's beginning to explode because I come down in this olive grove. You can't imagine the sound. I never heard sounds like this in my life, or such a cacophony of, oh, that's almost driving me crazy, that sound, you know. But I'm safe. I'm safe in this thing, and I was.
So the sound you hear is your wings coming down through the limbs of these olive trees.
That's right.
And in a sense, they broke your fall or slowed you down, brought you to a stop?
Yeah. I was like, I had to experience already the dropout when that engine was not producing it at all. And this one's gone, and this one is not. It's going, but it's not. You're losing altitude immediately, you know.
So you're tearing through the olive trees, and there had to be some significant impact, I'm thinking. You had to feel something when you brought that bird in.
Yeah, I don't recall feeling anything because I was just strapped in.
It wasn't bumpy?
Bumpy. Oh, bumpy, sure. Yeah, it was bumpy and rough, but noisy. It was so noisy you couldn't think, you know.
Uh-huh.
I had to land it. Don't try to turn. Do anything. Just get this thing on the ground straight out. And that's what I did. And it began to explode all before I was out of the, could get out of the cockpit. No problem getting out of the cockpit. Do it like this, but take off your parachute before you're trying to run away from a plane that's exploding. So I get over behind a tree, an olive tree, put my back to the explosion, and here comes the ambulance. The ambulance, no. From the, well, here it is, a hospital. It takes us like 90 seconds to get from where I am to get in the hospital, to get help immediately. I had to take my goggles up so that I could see because there was smoke in the cockpit and flames already. Well, the minute I got down there were flames. And, of course, that burned me.
You mean on your way down, you couldn't see because it's already smoking up, and so you had to take the goggles off to see where you were going.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly, yes.
So then when you hit and it starts burning, your face got burned.
Yeah.
How bad was that? What was the extent?
Oh, they go 1, 2, 3, first, second, and third burns. And you could tell where you got your goggles up, but you still have this part of your face. And so you had... the whole face was kind of seared, but this was burned up here. But they had me, in a stretcher and in a doctor's office within minutes.
Mm-hmm.
No, don't put this in your script, Stoutenboro, because this doesn't make sense. This doesn't happen this way. You don't land beside a hospital.
What you're saying is you were very fortunate to survive.
Oh, yeah. I could be where. Could never get help for a long time. And so whatever the burn was, you'd still be able to see it. You still can see it. Without attention, that thing would be, today it would probably look very, very rude up there, you know. It brought me to my senses, but I just had all the faith in the world in that plane. And there we were. The plane just exploded, and I got rid of my tanks, of course. See, we were going up with belly tanks, but I got rid of those. If I'd landed with those belly tanks, of course, I wouldn't be here, probably.
That explosion would have been a lot bigger.
Oh, yeah.
It would have consumed you, probably.
Yeah. But I really wasn't in combat. I told the doctor, he says, oh, get off.
So you tried to turn down the Purple Heart because you hadn't finished the mission and actually done your assignment.
That is true.
So how long were you in the hospital?
Oh, goodness. Long time. 2 months. They very, very carefully took care of me. Of course, penicillin every 6 hours.
And by this time, you were married?
Yeah. I had my 50 missions, and my wife, I said, well, do you want to get married now, or do you want to wait till I finish going? Because I want to get to the Pacific. Well, let's get married now. So we did. We had a military wedding, you know, and then I went back. I thought I was going to the South Pacific, but no, they're sending me to Miami on a train. It doesn't sound like South Pacific. And that time I had a ride over in a plane from Natal to Dakar.
Well, and I bring up Phyllis because I'm just wondering. I mean, you have this extremely close call with this crash landing and an exploding plane, and now you have a wife to be concerned about that you're hoping to get home to, and maybe even in that hospital bed wondering, what's she going to think when she sees me like this?
Precisely. No, I thought I'd be messed up. So I wrote her a letter. Of course, I wrote her a letter blind because they had me blindfolded.
So they've got bandages over your face and you can't see the paper, but you wrote her a letter anyway?
That's right. And of course, I have a ruler that I'm supposed to get this. Well, it turns out I've got a fan here because I'm pulling the ruler down and writing up to where the tails on words or letters don't know.
So you're saying when she got it, she had to keep rotating the page to be able to read it.
Well, that's true. Yeah. No, you could read it if you just put your head around, you know. I was making it like a fan. I wasn't moving the whole ruler up there. So it's hilarious. I'm telling her things that I'm in the hospital and I got boogered up and I don't know what I'm going to look like, you know, but I love you and I'll probably be home soon.
Well, and I can't imagine it was very encouraging for her to see that letter if you can't even write straight. She's wondering what's going on with you.
Right. Oh, she could figure out what I'm... Yeah, right.
And I can tell that you know, you enjoy laughter and you're pretty lighthearted about all this, but that's a serious situation. You just almost died and almost left her a widow. What did you think about in the hospital for those months as you're waiting to hopefully go home and see her again?
Oh, what are they going to have for dinner? It was a great hospital in Bari.
Bari, Italy.
Bari, yeah. Italy. Uh-huh. Fine hospital. They wanted to fix my teeth, you know. I'm in the burn ward. I'm not serious, but some of those guys were... One guy was having his arm grow skin. He had, I don't know how to express it, but he had to grow skin that they could use.
Right.
So he was there for a long time. To graft it, that's right. He was there for a long time. But no, there was no pain. It was just uncomfortable, and I didn't know precisely how it would turn out. I just didn't want to be be scared by this crash, because it didn't bother me. I saw people that were hurt, you know, ooh, in that hospital. God, I wasn't hurt.
Perspective is a powerful thing, isn't it? And after hearing the story of that crash landing, its proximity to the hospital, and overall what a close call that really was, I'm pretty sure there are some sons and grandchildren, 5 of those, 2 great-grandchildren that are oh so thankful that Dawn Stoutenborough made it out alive. It's break time again, but don't forget to check out the captivating photos by Zach Coco of Pictures for Heroes. I have them up for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find a photo of Dawn with the revolutionary heart valve that has changed his life. And speaking of images, it was the moving variety film of an important World War II moment that he didn't even know he was carrying in his P-38 toward the end of the war in Europe. Who were those film canisters destined for? And why did Don find himself in hot water? He'll explain that to us when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to discuss one of those warbirds that always draws a reaction, the fork-tailed P-38 Lightning, with a man who flew 76 missions in them in World War II. If you happened to attend UC Riverside, Don Stoutenborough might have been your English or drama or speech instructor. But at the end of World War II in Europe, this decorated pilot had a very unique experience. Harry Truman had been president for only a matter of weeks after the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt, and why would a battle-tested 22-year-old P-38 pilot who'd already survived a fiery crash landing think that an overnight delivery he was asked to make might possibly relate to the newly installed commander-in-chief?
Here I'm at Wing, and I have a friend, Waterhouse is his name, Stoutenborough and Waterhouse. Sounds like a legal crew, doesn't
sure
it?
Sure does, yeah.
All right, we're at Wing Operations. If somebody wants something done in one of the squadrons out there, they called Wing. Could somebody go do this for us? This time the thing came in, we would like a courier with a toothbrush.
Courier with a toothbrush.
Oh, all right. I thought this is going to be an overnighter. I hope to get this. Well, Waterhouse, you know, we took a deck of cards and then the card. I get the King of Diamonds. He got a seven of something. Oh, poor Waterhouse. He says, oh, he was so mad because it was with a toothbrush. We didn't know where we're going to go. I know, you know. So this was a very, very nice routine I was going into.
Great assignment. Sounds promising.
Except, where was I going? I found out where I was going when I got to Naples. I fly my plane over to Naples, and it's late afternoon, and I'm going to London. Okay. I'd never been to London, of course.
Do you have any idea what it is that you're carrying, what you're delivering?
No. They All said, right. You're this cumbersome 40-pound, awfully difficult. I have to put it on my hip bone, you know, over here.
It's so big, you have to use your leg to help carry it.
Uh-huh. It's very heavy. 40 pounds, I think it would be. Anyway, it was full of film.
Big canisters of film, in this case, a heavy case.
Right. Now, uh-huh. I didn't know what it was until I got there.
So you just know you've got this heavy case and it's got to go to London.
Have to go to London. I have to wait for it to arrive. It isn't even there.
Okay.
Waiting for it to come. Okay, I'm thinking, well, we'll do it tomorrow. No, it's just be there. I'm thinking, I'm going to London, to Bovington. Turns out that's the VIP landing place. Mm-hmm. Important people that went there. And finally, we get it. And finally, I get the weather. And finally, the plane is ready, and I'm on my way to London. I've been briefed that the weather is okay. It's all quite doable. And so I take off and fly to London up the Loire River. I'm enjoying the flight. I'm not going to go too high because I want to be able to see what I get. But I'm going there. I'm not taking any time off. I'm going the same direction. The package is behind me, and it's late afternoon. But when I got in view of the Eiffel Tower, I could see, but I couldn't see. What was that? You know, is that fog in the air by the Eiffel Tower? You can see what the weather is over there. Well, I don't mean that I saw lightning or anything like that, but I saw it, and it's late, but I'm coming into Bovington. I don't know anything about it. Thank God I didn't try to do it. Believe me. I couldn't even find it the next day. I'm thinking I'm going to a strange airport. We're going to find it. I bet you it's going to be camouflaged. Boy, talk about camouflaged. They'd done a farm. I landed in a farm with cows in it. Well, they went to a hell of a lot of trouble to put the important people at a safe camouflaged facility.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to bomb that place. You couldn't see it. I wouldn't have seen it. So I landed early. Okay. And I take my little friend, you know, with me to my room. I ask the guy, where should I eat? He says, I got a great place for you. Wonderful. It's in town. How long does it take to get to town? Oh, here's the bus. You know, bus. No problem. So he directed me, and I said, I'll have to take this thing with me. What do you got there? I said, I don't know. They didn't label anything. Didn't say most secret or no. I took it with me downtown because I was going to eat this wonderful mess for just officers. It was a French restaurant, but not really. It was a wonderful meal. But I had this on my hip the whole time. I was getting a sore hip, actually. But I was downtown. It was night, of course, dark, pitch dark. And they were having an election. boy, it was exciting because the real people were out on the streets and they were getting some returns from the mission. I don't speak French, but I could figure the happiness and the excitement it was going on. And so I was just enjoying everything except this thing on my hip. But I was so happy to be there, and the food was incredible because it's GI food from America fixed by a French chef in this officers' club with my thing I could put on the floor, you see. Oh, I was in heaven. Why? I'm so lucky, lucky, lucky. Okay, so I finally, I caught the bus back. I knew how to do that. The phone is ringing for you, Stoughtonboro. Oh, this number. Call it, London. This guy was, his voice, gibberish, really, really. He couldn't even tell me how mad he was. I did not think it was safe to come, sir. I'm not familiar with your airport over there.
You weren't going to dinner. You went to dinner downtown in Paris.
I said, I have to eat somewhere, sir. I'll be there tomorrow. I said, what I've got in here is not food. It's not going to spoil. I have it with me. I've never left it. Your product is absolutely safe in my... I have the hip. I can show you to prove I've carried it with me. And he said something like, don't you take that tone with me. Well, he was a full bird colonel. I didn't mean to take a tone with him, but I was just telling him that I didn't think it was safe to come. I would not have made it if I had done it, because I couldn't see it the next day. Sun bright. They were very impatient. You are exactly over us, sir. P-38, you are there. We're looking at your bottom, you know. Just look out. I says, I can't. I'll have to turn the plane to look at you. Please do that, because I couldn't find it. So they talked me down to the farm. I avoided the cows. I mean, it was camouflaged very carefully. Whatever the situation would be, they couldn't have talked me down at nighttime. So I'm there, have nice breakfast. I go over to London at Bovington, and there's a jeep waiting for me. Anyway, he rings me up, and I'm introduced to the full bird colonel. And there's just something about him immediately. I think he's really mad at me, isn't he? And he was so mad at me that he couldn't really talk to me, you know. You're going to learn about this, sir. Do you know what you were carrying? No, sir, I do not, sir.
It was for the president. For last night, President Truman was, I am going to talk to your General Struthers.
So what did you ultimately learn about what it was you were carrying?
He told me what it was.
Tell us, what was it?
It was this film of the surrender of Italy. The film beginning to end, well, I don't know how much film do they need? So there have to be something else going on there, or maybe there are many copies of it, I don't know. It was 40 pounds. And it was for the president, Truman. And was it only time I talked to your general?
So he's reading you the riot act.
Oh, really did, really did. So I come home and I tell the general, sir, you're probably going to get a call from a colonel, they named him, from London, complaining about my staying in Paris. Mm-hmm. And he says, what outfit is he in? You know, they get the celebrities over here. Then laughter from my general. He says, stop. You're kidding me. He says, Stout, how many people are in your plane? I said, one. He says, who's in charge of your plane? Who's the captain of your plane? Who makes the decision about what the plane's going to do? I says, of course, I have it. So he can go hang it up, get mad about what? You didn't think it was safe, and as it turns out, it probably wasn't. He says, I've been to that field. He says, you didn't do the wrong thing at all. That is the best camouflage, I think, that they've done. That's a historic camouflage job, Bovington. I felt relieved. The fact that he says, what outfit is you say he's from, you know? And he laughed. So what did that guy having to do with entertainment telling this captain that he had to be there the night before?
So you're off the hook.
I am completely off the hook.
And the president just had to wait a little longer to see that footage.
Probably saw it just as quickly. I got up early, you know, I had breakfast, and I got into London quickly. So they had the whole day to get that thing across the Atlantic.
I guess there's one more question I have to ask you on that. Had you known what it was and who it was for, would you have acted any differently?
No, I would not. When I saw it, when I landed there, you did the right thing, Stout, you know. camouflage can fool me. I'm a sucker. I have two versions of what happened when I get credit for two planes shot down. One says they're confirmed, and one says they're not confirmed. I've always liked the idea that I didn't kill anybody. You claim one, but you claim one with people who were there. They verify. You don't make it up. You know, both cases, I was a wing person. I wasn't the leading of the flight. One was a 109 and one was a 190. Mm-hmm. So I got a Falkwolf and a Messerschmitt. Now I've got two books, and one of them says I did it. Two of them confirmed. I can show you in the book. And another book, not this book in here, says those were not confirmed. I thought, that's the one. It's true. It's true. I don't want the credit for shooting a guy down. If I really did it, you know, I hope he hit the sack. I wouldn't. I didn't like killing anybody.
So I want to understand here. Are you saying you shot the plane down, they gave you a Distinguished Flying Cross for it, but for your own state of mind, you don't like thinking about what might have happened to the pilot of that other plane?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I shot a lot of planes. I shot a lot of locomotives. I keep looking for it on the television. It's just too much to believe. What a wonderful explosion beneath my plane, all on film. And then Stoutenborough. This is what they showed you the movies.
Afterwards,
you know, everybody could go to the movies. I didn't know. I knew I shot the locomotive, but I didn't know it was that beautiful or that dramatic or that explosive.
You're not saying so much that the guy who wrote up your citation was lying. You're saying it's uncomfortable for you to think about it in those terms.
Yeah, if they're not confirmed, fine. That's the way I go. I don't think there wasn't anybody there. If it did, he bailed out. I'm pretty happy to know that it's not confirmed. You know, so how neat. You know, how neat. I am loving what I'm doing, and now I didn't hurt anybody. Now the guy in the locomotive. Where did he go? The locomotive guy, I can't make anything.
You can't do any mental gymnastics to avoid that one. I just don't want anyone hearing it to be confused. That's why I asked you so many times. So I just wanted to get the right understanding.
Well, all right. This is my first tour. First tour. The flight leader was a first lieutenant. Now, he's my superior, baby. Mm-hmm. And he said I shot it. He confirmed that I did it. Okay, that's fine. I do it. I live with that. And then it's published that, no, this is not confirmed. And I think, well, how nice. Wonderful. I didn't hurt anybody. I had never been happier than when I had a P-38 in charge of it. I loved that plane. Every day I would thank whomever for the good luck I was having. I didn't get killed. I had 76 missions. I wanted to stop at 75, but that last mission I knew was a good one, and so I did 76. So I had 15 oak leaf clusters.
What would you say you're most proud of?
That I did what I did, and that my wife was with me.
And she'd be with him for the rest of her life. Don and Phyllis enjoyed 57 years of marriage after tying the knot in those turbulent times of World War II. She was with him as he used the GI Bill to attend the University of Southern California. They raised three sons as Don went on to run a successful motel business, become a college instructor at the University of California in his hometown of Riverside. He served as national sales manager for Spoken Arts, an educational multimedia company, and he spent many years as a volunteer docent at Palm Springs Air Museum. You've heard me tell you that the reason we have the privilege of meeting such an amazing array of veterans on this show is because of people who listen, people like you. You reach out to me and you tell me about the vets in your life. The privilege of meeting Don came from Edwards Life Sciences, which had celebrated many of the World War II veterans who'd received their transcatheter aortic heart valve replacement. From what I'm told, some folks assume they're just slowing down, when really their fatigue might come from a narrowing of a heart valve that restricts blood flow. That was the case for Don, but I should let him tell you about it. Don, since I only got to meet you because of Heather and the team at Edwards Life Sciences, I guess I ought to let you explain the difference that heart valve has made for you.
Oh, well, I was dehydrated and I didn't know it. Ooh, problems. But this was part of the problem with the heart, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it, but I just knew that I didn't have any poo out here. I was used to walking at least 2 miles every day. And I can't do that. I haven't been able to bring it back up there. I could go a mile and a half. But I couldn't have done it if they hadn't given me the...
So you lost one of your engines and then you got it back? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. Very good. Hey, I wish I'd said that.
Well, you said enough, and you did enough. Thanks for your candor, and thank you for your service. Don Stoutenboro, 95 years old. Don't forget to go online for those outstanding portrait-style photographs by Zach Coco of Pictures for Heroes. Eventually, that project of Zach's is going to become a book, and some other vets who you've heard here on the radio over the years will be featured in it as well. I have all that information linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, as well as the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. Right now, it's time to bring this episode in for a landing, but thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses going to your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.